I was told I'd be shaved. All the way from the top of my hair to the sole of my feet. Cleanly shaved. My lashes and brows would also be clean, and my toenails would be clipped and covered with a special type of material to make them softer and accommodate me into a new type of life that was possible on the other side of the portal. Any extremities on the body poking out of my flesh when I poured it through the machine was dangerous to myself and to the mission. "It's like being born again, Dave," Mr. Rosenberg said to me. Mr. Rosenberg insisted human beings were yet to find the cure for the sundry illness because we were looking at the symptom of an event rather than checking for the source of it. Children, he said, were the most important element to look out for in solving most of the world's problems with illness and disease. He alluded to the biblical Christ. Humans did not need sex to reproduce. It was all the work of an alien civilization populating our species. If it wasn't so, every time humans had sex, a child would be born, he argued. I didn't care for his argument, so I let him go. But humans are too soft to the needful, and we fawn over those little beings, seeing ourselves in them and wishing to protect them when we should be protecting ourselves from them. The children who come to the earth through the belly of their parents, with hairs or nails on their body, are impure beings transported from other realms to ours, and they bring their filthy diseases with them. Mr. Rosenberg insisted that he had submitted papers with evidence documenting what he was talking about, but nobody had cared to listen. So, he had turned his attention to something far more convincing. Time travel. The machine was a gray pod with a post on each side and a sliding bar over the door, so that once one was inside, only someone from the outside could turn it open. Mr. Rosenberg said it was better that way because the aliens could figure he understood how time traveling through birth works, and they would try to destroy his machine if they knew exactly where it was. How the machine worked was unsophisticated. He had a button to turn it on and a button to turn it off. It was so simple by design that a complicated civilization would struggle with accessing it, he mused. Genius. He applied some foul-smelling material to my nails and guided me into the pod. It was then that I started to feel uneasy, asking myself if it was all worth it. His offer was good. He had $500 for anyone who would go into his pod, see into a different time, and come back with a testimony of what it was like. I had a plan of my own. Mr. Rosenberg was a madman, but he was a madman with money. Money which I needed because times were hard. I had concocted the most elaborate story of a future time when houses were made from a material that could disappear upon command and still be present enough to house residents. It was a time when people did not need cars, and they could port anywhere they wanted and as much as they wanted. It was this plan that consumed my mind as I stepped into the pod and found myself adjusting into a comfortable spot with Mr. Rosenberg outside, shutting me in. Once I was shut in, the machine started to drone, an ear-pinching noise that made me dizzy. I put my hands over my ears to remove the assaulting noise from my senses. Then a strange sensation overwhelmed me. It was a change in the smell inside of the pod. It smelled nothing like oxygen. It was heavier in the nostrils, and I struggled to take much of it in. I panicked, terrified at the thought of suffocating in the pod. I had never been claustrophobic before that moment, but in that small time, I was transported to hell itself. I wanted out of the pod, and I banged on the door forcefully. The crude smell of the air lingered, and the more I struggled to breathe, the more I suffered. My beating heart thudded slower and slower until its echo in my ears turned faint. I had no awareness of the time and place, and my limbs were at least 100 times heavier than my senses recall them to be. My limbs dropped to my side, and my knees buckled. I slumped in the pod and held my breath longer one final time, instinctively. My eyes drifted close, and I heard the pod being opened from the outside. I had felt all of the dizzying effects of the machine, but when the pod was open and fresh air came back to me, I enjoyed some invigoration. In a bid to make my testimony more believable, I was in no haste to speak to Mr. Rosenberg. I simply remained as I was, eyes shut and limbs relaxed. Mr. Rosenberg spoke without trying to wake me up, and I had never felt as chill as I had in my life when he confessed his true intent. "I hope you taste better than the last one," he mummed close to my ear as he bent over to pick me up and dump me onto his trolley. My blood ran cold in my body as I pondered on what he could possibly have meant. I only wanted $500. Mr. Rosenberg rolled me in his trolley into a freezing room as I continued to play dead, and what I saw confirmed the worst horror I could have imagined when I heard his words. He dumped my body on the floor, and I slit my eyes open to the sickening view of another neatly shaved human with a portion of his chest cut off. I threw up in my own mouth as the stench of bloodied flesh sunk into my nostrils. "Aha!" I heard Mr. Rosenberg say with the accompaniment of blades clanging. My heart almost burst out of my chest from how horrified I was. The pace of my blood pumping through my body offered some internal warmth in the cold freezer. Mr. Rosenberg's gloved hands grabbed my shoulder and he turned me over. He suddenly had the eyes of the devil himself, black and utterly evil as he held that knife over me, ready to kill me off for his cannibalistic enjoyment. I wasn't thinking clearly when I reacted. I attacked his hands bearing the sharp knife and slammed it up against his face. The pointy end of my blade missed his face by inches, but jammed into the more fatal area of his neck. "You are not dead," he muttered, choking on sputtering blood as he fell to his knees. He clutched the air and cried in agony as the knife in his throat drained him off his blood. I could hear his dying cry when I was searching for my clothes, but I did not stop for a moment. The event was so jarring that even as I escaped from certain death at the hands of Dr. Rosenberg that day, I still cannot shake the thought of how foolish it would have been to be murdered over a promise of $500. I met Adam while working the late shift at the police station. It was a Friday night, and I was in charge of manning the jail cells where we put those arrested for DUIs, disorderly conduct, and those types of situations. The one where they're behind bars until one night when someone bails them out. My shift started at 10 p.m. By the time I reached the desk, there were already a few people who got caught. In the woman's cell was a single woman with a tight red dress, messy hair and smeared makeup. I'd seen her before, so she took her usual seat and waited patiently for someone to bail her out. In the men's cell, there were two men. One must have been a bodybuilder or something. He was massive and covered in tattoos. The other guy hugged his knees in the corner opposite the big man. He was scrawny and clearly had never been incarcerated before, so he sat shaking like a leaf, watching the big man closely. The big man paid him no mind and conversed with the other guard about the Kansas City Chiefs season. I wondered if the scrawny guy got caught with the woman in the red dress and that's how he ended up here. "We got another one for you boys," said an officer walking in with a man dressed in all gray. I spoke up. "What did he do?" "Rambling nonsense, crazy stuff to an old man at the bar. The old man thought he was insane, so he called 911. But when we took him for a psych evaluation, he passed. They said he seemed a very sound mind, and they wondered if it was that old man who was causing issues." "So why do we have to hold him?" I asked. "They still got him on disorderly conduct." The man in gray looked between the two of us and shrugged. "Honestly, I have nowhere else to go, so I'm not complaining," he said. The officer led him to the men's cell, took off his handcuffs, and locked him in. "Hey, big man." The man in gray smiled at his cellmate. The big man looked him up and down and puffed off his chest to intimidate him, but the man in gray just laughed and sat next to the trembling man. I had never seen someone dressed like this man. He wore a long gray tunic and gray pants, all linen. The tunic buttons on the far right side of his chest, and looked like what someone would wear in a Star Wars movie. He was pale and his hair was greasy. "What's your name?" He looked at me. I looked at my fellow officer, back at that man. Yeah, you. What's your name? I'm Adam. Tom. He continued to talk to me. He asked me questions about how long I'd been a cop and what had caused me to pursue this track. Honestly, he seemed very friendly and all there. So, what happened with that old man? I asked him. He rolled his eyes. I was explaining how I got here and my background. He didn't believe, which is fair. I'm used to that. I started talking about some of the things and people I've encountered, and I must have said something that triggered him because he went ballistic on me. Then he said something that pissed me off, and I started yelling. I asked him what the man said that made him mad, and Adam shook his head. Doesn't matter much now, does it? I'm the one locked up, and he's probably cuddling up with his wife in a comfy bed somewhere. Something about him fascinated me. It's almost hard to explain, but I felt compelled to continue the conversation. How did you get here? I don't mean the incident with the old man. I mean, what did you tell him about how you got here? He sighed. He wouldn't believe me, man. I shrugged. Try me. He laughed. I'm from the future. Okay. I responded. You're right. I don't believe you. Seriously, though, how did you get here? He looked into my eyes for a moment before opening his mouth. I am from the future. We were fighting the Russians when they took me hostage. Technically, I'm a prisoner of war. I know to you that will seem crazy. I think they've only had me for a week, so that's why I seem put together for a war prisoner. I laughed, but he continued. He went on to explain a 50-year war between America and Russia. It was kicked off when Russia dropped a nuclear bomb on Los Angeles. I asked what year he was from, and he said 2122. According to him, time travel is the new form of water torture in the future. They ask you questions, and if you don't comply, they send you back to a random point in the past for a few hours before bringing you back. Sometimes, you get dropped somewhere where something horrible happened. He told me how one guy ended up in Japan the day they dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. He ran around panicking all day, but no one would listen to him. They all thought he was crazy. Another guy got dropped in a concentration camp. In that situation, they couldn't leave him there too long, or else the Nazis would have killed him. Then other times, like his current situation, they drop you somewhere harmless and you have to roam for hours until they bring you back. Adam went on to explain how slowly the constant parade of people who don't believe and time travelers start to make them question their own reality until they really do go crazy. People get to a point where they don't believe in themselves and are left in a confused state until they die. I mean, can that really happen just from people not believing you? Adam stood up and walked to the bar, so he stood across from me. He said, "Has anyone thought you were genuinely crazy, but you weren't? Or has someone lied about you and other people believed them no matter what you said? Or maybe you've been in an abusive relationship where your partner gaslit you until you didn't trust yourself anymore." I shook my head. Adam continued, "It's hard to describe to someone who has never experienced it. It's like anxiety on steroids. Never underestimate the power of belief, even if it is just a matter of people believing your word. When they don't, you begin to question it yourself, and you get caught in this spiral of not knowing whether they're right, or you have lost it, or they're all wrong. It's like being sucked into a mental black hole. Once it begins, it's inescapable unless all those who don't believe you change their stance. I hope you never understand that feeling. Take it from me, it is unpleasant." An officer walked in to relieve me of my duty so I could take lunch. "I want to hear more when I get back," I told Adam. "Do you believe me?" he asked. "I don't know," I answered. Even if he was crazy, he was compelling. When I returned from lunch, everyone was rushing around in a panic. I sat at the desk and swirled in my chair to pick up my conversation with Adam, but he wasn't there. I turned to my partner. "Someone bail out that guy in gray? They think he escaped, but we have no record that he was brought in." "What?" I swear to God, I turned around for a second and then he was gone. We tried to put an APB out on him, but couldn't find his information. All the paperwork we did also vanished, I guess. He explained that they checked the security footage to know he was there. The moment he supposedly vanished, the camera glitched. In one frame, there he is, and in the next, nothing. I have a feeling that I know what happened, but no one would believe me if I told them. I wish I could have told Adam I believed him before they took him back. My girlfriend passed away just over a year ago. It had been sudden, unexpected, as these things always were. She left one afternoon to get gas and never came home. It tore me apart. We'd been dating for almost a year at that point, and I really thought we were going to be forever. But it didn't happen like that. Those dreams were crushed in a heartbeat, in a crunch of metal and glass. It took me a long time to get past it. The silence, the absence in my heart. I felt guilty about moving on. I thought I would never be able to get past that part of my life, that I would be clinging onto these memories forever. But eventually, I realized that there was no point clutching on that grief. I had to let it go eventually. I got tired of coming home to an empty apartment. I got tired of the silent days and lonely nights. It wasn't healthy for me. Eventually, my friend suggested dating again. At first, I was against it. I felt like I would be betraying Alyssa by falling in love with someone else. But then, one night when I was feeling lost and a little bit lonely, I downloaded Hinge. I'd met Alyssa at a bar, so this was my first time using a dating app. I told myself there was no pressure. If I didn't hit it off with anyone, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I was used to being on my own. I set up a profile and then went to bed, leaving my phone on the table beside me. I didn't expect to receive any notifications, but when I woke up, I had one from Hinge. Rubbing the sleep from my eyes, I sat up in bed and pulled down my notification tab. Alyssa liked you. Match to continue the conversation. I swallowed back the lump in my throat, staring down at the name. Alyssa. Was that just a coincidence? Or was fate playing a cruel trick on me? A strange feeling welled up my throat, and I swiped away the notification, putting my phone back down. Maybe this was a bad idea after all. I climbed out of bed and slipped into the bathroom, taking a hot shower to wash away that unpleasant feeling that had risen inside me. What were the odds that a girl called Alyssa was the first person to like my profile? Fate was cruel indeed. I toweled off and went downstairs to grab some breakfast. I was halfway down the landing when my phone pinged from the other room. I hesitated. It was probably nothing. But something compelled me to turn around and go check it. I jogged back to my room. The air inside was cold, like I had left the window open, even though they were all closed. I shivered. My phone was laying face down on the table where I had left it. When I turned it over, a message flashed up from Hinge. Alyssa sent you a message. I frowned. I didn't think users can message you unless you matched. Was I mistaken? Or was it some kind of glitch? Despite the uneasy tremble in my heart, I opened the app to see who this Alyssa was. When I clicked on her profile, I almost dropped the phone. My fingers shook. The picture attached to their profile was Alyssa, my Alyssa, who had passed away in a car accident over a year ago. The photo was one I had never seen before, taken in a semi-dark room, but there was no doubt it was her. I still saw those soft brown eyes and high cheekbones in my dreams. Was someone playing a cruel prank on me? Did someone think it was funny to impersonate my dead girlfriend on a dating site? Some people had horrible, twisted minds. I open up the chat box. Hey Mark, did you miss me? My gut wrenched sharply as I typed out a reply. Whoever this is, leave me the hell alone. This isn't funny. You're sick. An ellipsis appeared under Alyssa's name, indicating she was typing on the other end. If this was one of my friends, I was going to find out which one and give them a piece of my mind. This was a horrible thing to do. What are you talking about? It's me, Alyssa. Don't tell me you forgot about me already. I was caught between wanting to shout and wanting to cry. Alyssa died over a year ago. Whoever this is, you need to stop. There was a long pause between the next message, and I felt my knees wobble when it came. I'm not dead. With a hard, trembling breath, I closed the app and tossed the phone onto the bed, clutching my head in my hands. What the hell? Who would do something like this? Why would they do something like this? To mess with me? My phone pinged, but I ignored it. I decided I would delete the app later and forget any of this happened. For now, I needed to get something in my stomach before I threw up. I tried to forget about the app and the messages I had received, but it was on the back of my mind for the rest of the day. Who was behind the account? Why would they be messing with me like this? It didn't make sense. It had to be one of my friends. They were the only ones who knew I'd made a Hinge account. I hadn't checked my phone since that morning, and when I went upstairs to grab it, I had over 10 new notifications, all messages from Alyssa. I gritted my teeth, pulling up the chat. Mark? Are you there? I'm sorry if I upset you. I thought you would be happy to hear from me again. It's been so long, Mark. I miss you. Did you miss me? Please come back, Mark. It's really me, I promise. Don't you believe me? Are you there? Leave me the hell alone. I know this isn't Alyssa. It is me. Then where are you? The chat fell silent. I scoffed. Of course they couldn't answer that. Not without giving away the facade and revealing this all to be nothing but a lie. I don't know. Somewhere dark. Somewhere cold. A bitter taste filled my mouth, and for a moment, I had the image of Alyssa lying 6 feet beneath the earth, her fingers scrabbling weakly at the lid of her coffin, her voice hoarse as she cried to be let out. I hastily shook the image away. Alyssa was dead. She had been for over a year. There was zero possibility that she was alive. The person on the other side of the chat was an imposter. That was the only explanation. Please leave me alone. The chat fell silent and I sighed in relief. Maybe finally they would stop bothering me, dragging up those feelings of grief and loss I had tried so hard to forget. I clicked off the Hinge app and was about to uninstall it when another message flashed up on the top of the screen. The air around me went cold, seeping into my bones like an unearthly chill. I can't do that. I'm already outside. My heart pounded like a drum against my ribs as I stared at the message, my mind struggling to process what I was reading. Alyssa was outside? How is that possible? She was dead, buried in the cold, unforgiving earth. A wave of terror washed over me, and I scrambled to my feet, my legs trembling beneath me. I rushed to the window, my eyes scanning the darkness outside, desperately searching for any sign of Alyssa. The backyard was empty, bathed in the eerie glow of the streetlights. There was no one there, no sign of movement, but the message from Alyssa was still there, etched on the screen of my phone, a chilling reminder of her presence. The silence of the night was deafening, broken only by the sound of my ragged breaths. I couldn't shake the feeling that I was being watched, that a pair of unseen eyes were following my every move. Suddenly, a gust of cold wind swept through the room, causing the curtains to billow and the temperature to drop dramatically. I shivered involuntarily, a sense of dread creeping over me. As if in response to the chill, a message from Alyssa popped up on my phone. My heart leaped into my throat as I stared at the screen. I'm here, Mark, the message read. I've come back for you. I turned to flee, but my legs felt like lead, refusing to obey my commands. I watched in horror as the front door creaked open, revealing a shadowy figure. I screamed, but my nothing came out. It swarmed over me, the icy touch running all over my body. And then there was nothing but darkness. I woke up in the morning, physically tired but mentally fresh. To this day, the events of that night confuse me. The shadow and its touch, it was definitely Alyssa, but not in the form that I knew. It was like the whole night she kept me happy. I wouldn't say that I wasn't scared. I was completely spooked out. But even during these moments of horror, I enjoyed each and every second. Tell me, my friends, was it just a dream? Or is my Alyssa truly there? Have you ever experienced something like this in life? Thank you.
My sister Lucy disappeared 3 years ago. She didn't leave a note. On the days before she left, she didn't seem different in any way. She wasn't depressed or scared. She was just going to school and living her life. On the day she left, as we all ate dinner together and talked about nothing in particular, none of us could have predicted that we'd never see Lucy again. The next morning, when we realized that she wasn't home, we called all her friends. No one knew where she was. We went into her room, and aside from a suitcase and some clothes, she left everything else behind. One day she was in our house, and the next she was gone. We reported her disappearance to the police, but since she was already 18 and there wasn't any evidence of foul play, they didn't even file a report. I miss Lucy so much, but as the years went by, I thought about her less and less. And then last week, I was scrolling through Instagram when I saw her again. It was a sponsored ad for Carver Dance Studio, which is a business I'd never seen before. Aside from the heading, the ad had no text or other information, just a video of Lucy dancing in front of a black background. Her hair was longer and she looked so much older, but it was definitely her. She was doing some beautiful ballet moves, but her expressions were completely blank. I watched that video over and over, and each time I did, I felt haunted by the look on her face. It was emotionless. Back when she lived with us, she never stopped smiling. Mom always called her a ray of sunshine, but this Lucy was very different. I clicked on the ad, of course, which took me to the Carver Studio website. The site offered no information at all, just a list of videos. Hundreds of them. All of girls dancing in front of that same black background. Each girl was different, but they all did the same moves. After scrolling through thousands of thumbnails, I got to the bottom of the website, which had a Contact Us link. I clicked it, but that just brought me back to their Instagram account. I knew I should have told Mom and Dad right away, but they still hadn't gotten back from their Hawaii trip, and I couldn't wait. So I followed the account and sent a single message. Hi, where is your location? They never responded. I considered calling the police, but I wouldn't even know what to say. My adult sister ran away from home, and now she's dancing for some studio? It didn't seem like any laws were broken. It seemed like Lucy had moved on. She'd found a job and become a dancer. I had a really bad feeling about this studio, but I couldn't really explain that to the police. So I decided that it was best if I just waited for Mom and Dad to get home and maybe get as much information as possible before they got back. I tried to Google them, but nothing came up. Aside from their Instagram and their website of videos, it was like Carver Studio didn't exist. For the next few days, I felt a thrill of anticipation every time I opened Instagram. Would there be another video of Lucy? Would I finally get some clue as to where she'd gone? Each day, at least two more dancing videos were posted by Carver Studio, but none of them had Lucy. It seemed like every video had a different girl. They never repeated. By Friday, the last day before my parents came back, I opened Instagram and was shocked to see something different. Instead of posting another dancing video, Carver Studio posted a photo of an old warehouse with text in front of it inviting women to a dance audition that day. The building looked awful and run down, not the kind of place where a legitimate business would hold an audition. At the bottom of the photo, you could even see the barbed wire fencing that surrounded the building. The caption had an address, 423 Lark Street. It also had a time, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. only. That was it, no other information. Once again, a really dark feeling came over me. This felt wrong, very wrong. But at least I had an address. I knew that I needed to go there. This might be my only chance to find out what happened to my sister, and if I wanted to get some answers, I knew that I'd have to swallow my fear and head over there myself. I was scared, of course, so I decided to call my friend Sarah and ask if she would go with me, strength in numbers or whatever. I explained everything to her, and thankfully she didn't seem nearly as freaked out as I was. She said she'd come pick me up and we'd drive over there together. She just needed to change outfits first. I tried to explain that we weren't actually going to audition for them, but she said that it didn't hurt to be prepared, By 1 o'clock, she'd gotten to my house, and by 1:30, we arrived at the warehouse. It was on the seedier side of town, surrounded by abandoned buildings and an unused train track. We parked. There were no other cars outside. "I'm having second thoughts," I said. She grabbed my hand and squeezed it. "It'll be okay. We're doing this for Lucy." That gave me the motivation I needed to get out of the car. We walked through the barbed wire gate and knocked on the rusted door. We waited for a long, tense moment until the door creaked open. No one was on the other side, and the whole place looked dark. For the first time, Sarah seemed as scared as I was. That somehow made me feel better. From the darkness inside, a man's voice shouted,
"Well, are you here for the audition?"
"One sec," Sarah shouted. Then she leaned close and whispered, "I think we should call the police just in case." I nodded.
"Take your time," the voice from inside told us.
He spoke with an accent I couldn't quite place. Maybe Russian? I pulled out my phone and started backing away from the door. Sarah stood where she was, just smiling nervously. When I was far enough away from the warehouse to avoid being overheard, I dialed 911 and told the guy where we were. I explained that nothing had happened, but we really needed them to send someone over. The guy seemed confused, but he said that an officer was on his way. As I hung up my phone, I glanced back at the open door, and it was closed. Worse, I didn't see Sarah anywhere. "Sarah?" I shouted, "Sarah?" She didn't answer. I ran back to the door and pounded my fist against the rusted metal. "Open up!" I demanded. "Now!" I heard the lock click into place, and then I heard the man's voice again.
"Thank you, but the auditions are over."
In less than 5 minutes, a policeman pulled his car into the lot. By then, I was in a total panic. I explained everything that happened, though I don't think he understood everything I was saying. All my words came out in a jumble. Still, he could tell from my panicked explanation that my friend had been taken into the warehouse. With his gun ready, he charged towards the door, ready to kick it open. He didn't need to, though. The door was unlocked. For a second, he disappeared into the darkness, and I worried that he'd be taken too. But when he came back out, all he said was,
"There's no one in there, ma'am. I'm so sorry."
It's been 2 days since this happened. The police did a full search of the area, but they didn't find a single trace of anyone or anything nearby. It was like the warehouse had always been empty. I showed the officer my Instagram, but Carver Studio had deleted its account. They said they'd be doing some digital sleuthing to see what they can find, but I haven't heard anything else. Mom and Dad got back yesterday, and they've been trying to comfort me, but I'm losing hope. I think that Sarah's gone forever, just like Lucy. And every few minutes, I pull out my phone and open Instagram, silently praying that I'll see a video of either of them, just to know that they're still alive.